Hello, friends in the Bay Area. Shane Company has moved to a new location in Cupertino, and those doors are open. We're still on Stevens Creek Boulevard, but down the street from our previous location. You've got to come in. We've kept everything you love about Shane Company: the largest selection of fine jewelry, a relaxing shopping atmosphere with our non-commissioned team, a chance to compare two diamonds side by side, and a view of our jeweler's workshop. We've made a few updates, too: a spacious new showroom, rough gemstones you can actually hold, and a fun selfie station where you can get a photo of yourself in your sparkling jewelry. Find the perfect gift: an engagement ring or something for yourself. We're at 19900 Stevens Creek Boulevard. You can also visit us in San Mateo and Walnut Creek. Now you have a friend in the jewelry business: Shane Company and ShaneCo.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the newest episode of Bob Saget's Here For You. And depending on when you listen to this, because if you listen to it a month from now, it ain't the newest, but it kind of always will be to me, because my guest is Bob Newhart. That's right. One of the greatest of all time in comedy. Such a national treasure, Bob Newhart. And it's an audio-only podcast because Bob literally does not love the Zoom, and I don't blame him. And whatever Bob Newhart wants, I accommodate him here at Bob Saget's Here For You, where all sales are final and everything must go. And I've done audio podcasts before. My first one with John Stamos, I had one with John Mayer, with Bill Burr. Those were audio only, and you can still listen to them on the YouTube page at youtube.com/Bob Saget. And of course, you know where you can find this thing: everywhere, on all your podcast platforms. And you also, you need to rate, review, subscribe, leave a comment, make it not too negative. I take instructive criticism, just not evil. This guest is someone, well, I'm going to be telling him, but when I was 14, 15 years old, I snuck in to watch his sitcom, The Bob Newhart Show, being filmed in the San Fernando Valley at CBS Radford. And I will never forget it. And I didn't know I'd be in show business. Still not sure. And he's just the dearest and one of the funniest people, with his own brand, as he says, of Midwestern comedy, from his Grammy-winning comedy album, The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart, which literally made history, all the way through to The Bob Newhart Show, Newhart, Bob, and, you know, Elf. Come on. I mean, you know, it's going to last forever to see that movie every Christmas. He is just a wonderful, wonderful man. So here is the podcast with someone I am blessed to know in my life, Mr. Bob Newhart.
Hello.
It's Bob.
Hey. Oh, my God.
See that? It's not even difficult.
Oh, it's scary.
I know.
How's it sound?
It's amazing. That's what's so great about this. It's like studio quality sound. So it's not like a phone call. So it's like we're having a real conversation. Right. Yeah, it sounds awesome. And I'm sure you're going to want to hear it, because you've only been asked half of the things I'm going to want to talk about your entire life. Well, first thing, Bob, thank you for doing this. Thank you for
being on my podcast.
I over the years, if it wasn't for Rickles, I would have been much closer to you and just weaseled my way into your life more. you won't even believe how much I've followed you over the years.
Okay.
I mean, not followed you personally.
No, I know. Well, there, somebody has been.
I'm sorry. Do you want me to call anybody? Do you anybody?
No, it's just this person. For the last couple of weeks, it's every time I turn around, he hides behind a tree.
He's just outside.
Yeah.
Do you call security? Is there do you need me to come over?
Well, I used to call security, but then they got tired of it, And they won't even take my call now.
They just let the guy be there, just behind a tree.
I guess it's like if this nut Bob Newhart calls, don't pay any attention to him. I guess like that they have that posted at the police station.
I'm sure they do, because you've always been such a pest. It's exactly the opposite of your character. How are you doing? You're good. You've had the vaccine, and Ginny has had it.
Ginny's had it. I've had it. My 2 weeks are up, so I'm either impotent or no. There's another word for it.
Disinterested.
No, that's about the telecast. No, that's about the,
that's this. About what we're doing right now.
Yes. No, it's I guess I'm am I immobile? No, it's no, you're, it's something
you're,
like that.
Yeah, you're impenetrable. No, you're now, what's the word? You can't get the disease, apparently.
That's it.
In the worst case scenario. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the word. Everybody that's listening knows what the word is. They're all yelling it right now into their.
And you'll be, yes.
And I'll be the fool.
You get a lot of mail.
I'll drop. Oh, mail. I get so much mail. I do get comments. People do comment, and it's not always pleasant. It's like that guy out by the tree. You know,
I did a show, a man on the street show in like 57, and there was a host, and I was like the man on the street, and he'd interview me, and I was a different character every day, and this was on ABC television in Chicago.
You were doing advertising writing copy in 1958. So this was before or during that whole career as
this
well?
This is during this. I got fired from doing the copywriting.
Why?
So we did a half hour show every day, 5 days a week for 16 weeks. Cause you were talking about your mail.
Right.
And we got one postcard out of whatever, 5 times 16 is, what is that, 80? I guess, yeah, 80. Out of 80 shows, we got one postcard. We weren't even sure that the signal was getting out of the building, you know? And we were against Captain Kangaroo and Today.
Oh, that's tough stuff. That was the biggest rated stuff, right?
Tough time slot, yeah.
I stayed up last night. I know everything about you, but not everything. And then you look up. No, not no. That's good that I don't.
No.
But it was so interesting to see your journey, and you know, at the height of success with the Bob Newhart show, how that was probably the time where you were the most annoyed at your time slot, because you had such a beautiful gift of a time slot. You had been so successful for the network, and then they started to move you around a little bit. And I watched.
Like in the sixth, we went on in 72, the Bob Newhart show went on in 72. And so this would have been about 77. The show had not, CBS, the time slot on CBS on Monday night at 9 o'clock had not been a hit. We made it a hit, 9 o'clock. So they started switching things around, and they'd introduce new shows, and they'd move us to like 8:30 or 9:30. And I thought it was kind of unfair, which had been very good to them and very good to me, by the way, also. You know, I thought they were just being very cavalier about the way they were treating our show. And so I was about to, the show went on in 82. This would have been around 88.
Right.
And so I would have.
It lasted till 1990, right?
Yeah, it ran 8 years. The Bob Newhart show ran 6, and the. And Newhart ran 8, so at 14 altogether. Yeah.
So amazing. That's That's just unbelievable.
Yeah,
it really is. And then Bob ran for 2 years, I believe, or was it
like a year and a half? Year and a half, 2 years. Yeah,
I love Bob that show. There should be a law in broadcasting that you'd never remove Bob Newhart. I mean, you chose to leave the Bob Newhart show, correct?
I did. Yes, I did.
How do you do that with something that changed television? I mean, Mary Tyler Moore show was there first, and then MTM came to you, right?
Yeah. I was doing stand-up. This was, I had been doing stand-up for about 12 years, from like 1960 to 72, and then the Bob Newhart show was in 72, and it, I just felt we were, I always kind of go off a year too early rather than a year too late. And I'm sure you know, being in television is, I've seen shows that lasted a year too long, and it took a lot of the charm of the show was kind of gone, and I didn't want that to happen to the Bob Newhart show, so I elected to end it at the end of 6 years.
That's amazing, because you could have gone pretty much as long as you wanted with that show, I would imagine, right?
I keep telling myself that, yes.
I was...
That was pretty stupid is what you're saying, Bob.
Nope. But in today's world, like, the cast of Friends had to be coerced into doing their ninth year, you know? And then they realized...
At a million each, yeah.
Exactly. So that to me is like not that hard a decision, but they, I guess they felt they'd exhausted it. But it's, you know, not even knowing I was going to be a stand-up. I'm 14, 15 years old. I'm trying to think what year it was. It was right at the beginning of the Bob Newhart show. And I snuck in to your audience because you had to be 16. And I watched it being shot at CBS Radford. And I came a couple times to watch you do the show. And I was so in love with the show. And just, I was a kid. I didn't think I'd be doing this for a living. And I guess it was 1974 or three. I went a couple years to
it would have been 74. Yeah.
And you were Dr. Bob Hartley and Suzanne Plachette. It was amazing. I know she was one of your best friends in your whole life.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
She was marvelous. Susie was marvelous.
Yeah. And Bill Daly and Peter Bonners, right?
Peter Bonners. And I had been with Peter in Catch 22. I'm just reading the book on Mike Nichols. I'm just reading the book about Mike, and he had a chapter in there about Catch 22 and Marcia Wallace.
And Marcia Wallace was a doll. She was on Full House once. I knew Marcia. She was.
Oh, was she? Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and a lot of your directors, Peter Baldwin and Michael Zimberg.
They directed
Full House episodes as well, like the top of the directing craft. And Peter Bonners was always so charming and wonderful. And
yeah, he was. Peter was when I did the show, when I agreed to do the show, when MTM approached me about doing a show, I knew I'd have to get performers who were used to working in front of an audience, because we did our show in front of an audience. Mary did her show. Every show really then was in front of an audience. All in the Family, MASH wasn't in front of an audience because it was on location. And so I knew we would have to get performers who weren't spooked by an audience, because there are a lot of Broadway producers, or a lot of, not necessarily Broadway, but a lot of actors, film actors, were just not used to being in front of a live audience. And
right.
So I knew Peter had been, I knew Bill had been, Marcia had been, and of course, Susie had been on Broadway. So, you know, that was one of the considerations, was that they knew what it was like to work in front of a live audience.
It was miraculous. It was, and I saw Mary Tyler Moore show being filmed. And did Lorenzo Music do the warm up to your show?
No, I did the warm up.
You did the warm up. That's right. It was, he did the Mary Tyler Moore warm up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he was one of the, he was a writer. Lorenzo was a writer on the Smothers Brothers show. Mm-hmm. And I did an appearance and he wrote a piece of material for me, which was wonderful. And I wasn't used to getting, it was tough for me to find writers who wrote, who write for me, because they'd get the sound, but they wouldn't get the underlying comedy of what I did.
Right.
And so when I decided to do the show at MTM, Lorenzo and Dave Davis, who were writers on the Mary Tyler Moore show, were brought over to do the Bob Newhart show. And they were great writers. They're wonderful writers.
And Lorenzo became the voice of Garfield, which is...
Yeah.
Very funny man.
But I used to do the warm-up for the show because the audience, you know, I didn't want them to feel like, oh, okay, bring him in, get him to laugh and then get rid of him. You know, I wanted them to feel like that we cared about them, you know.
Right.
And it did make a difference. You could tell the audience, they were pulling for you because of that personal relationship.
That's who you are. That's why it's so beloved. And it was also smart. And I know that I read a lot of stuff about you, and you know that you have been concerned about the smartness of the audience. It wanes. Yeah. And there's something that, because you had done stand up for so long and really knew who your character was, and then you were able to do it in that original show. Do you remember what kind of stuff you did in the warm-up? Were there any set pieces that you did with people?
I do pieces of my stand-up. As any stand-up comedian, there'd be something in the news that week, and you'd just improvise. You go out and do it, and it worked. And no, because in my case, I learned stand-up backwards because I had that hit record, and then I had to learn how to be a stand-up, you know?
You had not been out with Button Down Mine, and then you went out after that and did stand-up?
Yeah, the Button Down Mine preceded the stand-up.
And you won the Grammy for that. That beat out, like, everything that year. It was crazy. How did that feel to you? It beat out Elvis Presley in the charts, it says, and the Sound of Music Broadway cast album. Here you were.
Yes. And Frank Sinatra and Belafonte. And it beat them in this one year. It was like
1960. You know,
1960, exactly. Yeah.
That's so amazing. It's definable. It's when you talk to stand-ups, you talk to anybody, literally anybody that knows comedy. It is just a miraculous piece. How long did you work on that material? And if you're not out doing stand-up, how did it come about? I know you'd always, as you said, you did man on the street type of stuff, but you also did kind of fake phone call stuff that you'd been doing.
Yeah, but what went on the album were just ideas that I had. I really had no outlet for them. They just struck me funny, like the Abe Lincoln routine and the driving instructor and the submarine commander. those were just ideas I had, and I did them on television in Chicago. My friend Dan Sorkin was a disc jockey, and he had me on his television show. And then he introduced me to the Warner Brothers record people, and I think 59. And
And they just started in 58, apparently. Warner Brothers Records.
Yeah, they hadn't.
Yeah.
Well, Jim Conklin was the head, and they had George Avakian, of course, you know, world famous for working with Louis Prima and Hal Cook, I remember. And they had just started, and Jim Conklin said, okay, none of this rock and roll stuff. Famously. Okay, because it isn't going to last. And so they weren't doing too well. They had the Everly Brothers, and they had Joni Summers. And so anyway, Danny, this friend of mine, that Warner Brothers Record people were coming through Chicago to call on Dan because he was a top DJ. And he said, I have this friend of mine that I think is very funny. And they said, well, have him put some of his stuff down on tape and we'll listen to it. And so Dan called me, he said, you know, get a tape recorder and make a tape and then, you know, and I'll play it for him. So I did, and he played it for him. They said, okay, all right, we'd like to sign him to a recording contract because Comedy Records were starting to make some noise, you know, Mort Sahl, Michael Lane, Shelley Berman, and Johnny Winters. And so they said, okay, we'll record you at your next nightclub. And I said, that's going to be kind of a problem because I never worked a nightclub. And they said, well, we will have to get you into a nightclub. And of course, no one would take a chance. I mean, this was a guy hadn't even done stand-up, you know? And then there's a club in Houston, the Tidelands, and they took a chance on me because I had a recording contract. And I made the record. I wrote 3 routines in 2 weeks when I was down in Houston because I only had one side of the album. I didn't have the B side. And the B side was No One Will Ever Play Baseball.
Right.
And the other one was the Wright Brothers. I wrote down there. And I made the record. And we had two shows, one on Friday night and then two on Saturday that we were going to record. And so I went out on Friday night. And there was a drunk in the audience who kept yelling out, that's a bunch of crap. That's a bunch of crap. That's a bunch of crap. All through my act. And we went up to listen to the tape and you could hear him better than you could hear me. So we had two shows on Saturday. So we made him, and then Bobby went. It went crazy. It just was far beyond anything I expected, and Warner Brothers or anybody else.
And so, did you start doing? You had to go start doing stand up after the album did what it did, right?
That's what I mean. So yeah, I kind of learned backwards because, here I was, and I didn't know how to do stand up. Because I did a show one time, and I had 18 minutes, and I did my 18 minutes, and the people were applauding, and the stage manager said, you know, go back, and I said, that's all I have, and he said, well, you go back, they're still applauding, so I went back out, and I said, which one would you like to hear again? So, with all the bravado I could muster, I walked on stage like I knew what the hell I was doing, and I learned my craft from the top.
There's nothing like that. That's where the people that are great come from. They just do it. They just do it for a long time.
And as you know, you have to look. You have to be in command of the stage.
Right.
If the audience suspects you're not in charge, forget it. You're lost. So you have to pretend like you know what the hell you're doing, even if you don't know what the hell you're doing, you know?
Yeah, that's what I do.
I've heard that. Yes.
Oh, yeah. That's a solid.
So what happened? You Ed Sullivan happens right after the album? Is that?
Yeah, I mean, like the record was out maybe 6 months, and all of a sudden my manager in Chicago said, do you want to do 6 Ed Sullivan's or 8 Ed Sullivan's? And I said, 6, you know, 6, you know, I don't think I can do 8. I don't have enough material for 8. So it was crazy. You know, it was insane.
And so that was, I mean, 50% of people watching television, because there's 3 networks, were watching Ed Sullivan. Yeah. So here you became the most one of the more well-known comedians in America at that point.
Well, it seemed like you were going to say the best.
Well, that you are to me.
And then you changed it to one of the best.
Well, one of the how do I dig out of this? You know, I worship you. I would say you were all of the best, but other people were also on.
All right. I'll take that.
It's all just right. Nice to be included. It's good to be nominated. But what was that like to go on Ed Sullivan? The only thing I can compare it to is when my first appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny was huge, because at that time there were 4 networks and some UHF and a couple cables. So that was still 30% of people watching TV were watching Johnny. But with Ed Sullivan, that's everybody. So what, were you nervous? You never seemed to be a man that got nervous.
Inside, I was panicked. But you can't show that, you know. So you cover it up, like I say, with bravado. You know you're in over your head, but you had this contract that you have to fulfill. You know? The first, I think I did Par before I did any Sullivan shows. And on the Par show, it was like the Tonight Show. And they had a star spot, and they just tell you to walk out. And they thought, you know, you have bow music. And then they say, okay. And then when you're finished, the band, you know, you have an out cue, and then just stand there and look over at Jack, and Jack will either be applauding or he'll call you over. And so I did what, I don't even know what routine I did. And I'm standing there, and it seemed like days, you know. And I look over, and finally he motions, come on over and sit down, which means you were good.
Right, right. Same as Johnny or David, if you got called over. And Jack Parr was, I met him once. He seemed like a lovely man.
He was very, very interesting. He did a different kind of Tonight Show. He had a stable of people, Charlie Weaver, John Viev, people won't even know who I'm talking about.
But, maybe if they look at old Hollywood Squares, Charlie Weaver was really popular.
Charlie, yeah, you're right. And then, Oscar Levant, he was a character, total character.
Right.
Jack poured his life into every show. And so at the end of about, I think it was about 5 years, 4 or 5 years, he was completely burnt out. He couldn't do another show. He put so much of himself into the show. And he quit NBC and he went to Japan and took a vacation and then came back some, maybe 10 years later.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah.
And it was different. I mean, he had a wonderful nervousness about him, probably neurosis and self-analyzing himself. And he had a timid way of talking. And I met him when I first got a job at CBS on a morning show. And he was very happy to meet me. And he was talking in that neurotic way I talk sometimes, or, you know, people, you've always had that way of being connected to what you're saying. And it yeah. allows the way I'm talking right now, which is people would call it a stammer, but it's not a stammer. It's a way of.
No, I have a stammer. I have the stammer.
I don't think so. Not to me. Maybe it's because I have one.
Yeah, but another stammer isn't aware of the other person's stammer.
You're right. So Biden doesn't seem like a Jimmy Stewart didn't stammer to me, you know.
No, well, there are stutterers and there are stammerers.
Right.
And stutterers get stuck on like a letter like P or S. But a stammer like myself, and now it turns out you, we get stuck on like words. And I think it's, although I have nothing scientifically to back it up, I think stammering is a higher form of stuttering.
So you are fairly confident in saying that you are much more evolved than a normal stutterer.
That's right. But I have no scientific proof of that.
No, this is none
personal,
at all.
Personal theory.
Right. Now, did you know?
I have to tell you a story about.
Please.
A guy who stuttered. His name was. I'm trying to think. I can't think of his name right now. But I'll tell the story. Anyway, he stuttered, and people weren't sure if he really stuttered, or if it was just part of his act. That when he wasn't doing his act, he's in New York, and he's staying at a flop house in New York, and he runs into a guy who's even worse off than he is. And he says to him, how you doing? He said, well, I don't have any place to stay. He said, well, you can stay at my place. I'll give you the address, but you got to come up in the fire escape. Cause if I have you in the room, then they know it's two people, it's double occupancy, and they'll charge me double. So he said, well, okay. Yeah. So the guy cleans up the fire escape and he gets into his room, and the phone rings, and it's the clerk downstairs. And he says, we know you have a guest, so we're going to charge you double occupancy. And he said, okay, but send up another Gideon Bible.
Because if you got two people, you're paying for two, you should have two Bibles. I mean,
that's right.
You know, you can't share a Gideon Bible with someone else that's with you. I haven't seen a Gideon Bible in a hotel room for a really long time.
I guess that's a sign of age.
Those are the good old days. I just want to go back for a second because there's a couple of things I didn't know about you. I cut you off because we're in Mike Nichols' Catch 22 and you were talking about it. And to me, that really was a sign from the book and from coming out of Vietnam and Alan Arkin and rebellion and where the country was at.
Yeah.
So what was your take? How did that movie role come about working with the great Mike Nichols and Alan Arkin, who we all also love? What was that whole, because it was a counterculture type of project.
It was an anti-war film, really.
Yep.
We were making it, that's the same time they were making MASH, the movie MASH.
Yep.
And Mike wanted me to play, his name was Captain Major, but then he was promoted to Major Major. And his last name was Major, so he became Major Major Major. And I mean, that's, you know, that's the way it starts off.
Right.
And
right.
In the book, Heller said, these are all the figments of Yossarian's imagination. That's one of the things he pointed out. These aren't real people. These are figments of Yossarian's imagination, where he thinks everybody is crazy. Mm-hmm. And he's the only sane one. So Mike said, so I didn't do that. I couldn't play it like I was a figment of Yossarian's imagination. I just played it for what I thought was funny.
Right.
And I'm not sure Mike, that's exactly what Mike wanted. But I was afraid if we played it as a figment of Yossarian's imagination, that it wouldn't be funny. Mm-hmm. People wouldn't laugh at that, you know, so
right.
I'm not sure Mike was thrilled with my performance, but
I'm sure he was, because he hired you to do it and knew you were right for it. And it's probably not what Joseph Heller, the writer of the book, would have envisioned.
That's
right.
That's right. Anyway, what happened was, because oddly enough, I was offered a role in MASH at the same time I was doing Catch 22, but out of loyalty to Mike, I declined the part in MASH.
What part would that have been?
I think it was the priest.
Oh, Father Mulcahy. Father Mulcahy, yeah.
I think so, yeah. Out of loyalty to Mike, I turned down the part of Father Mulcahy. And MASH came out before Catch 22.
Right.
And it took all the steam out of Catch 22, because it became the anti-war film. And mm-hmm. then Mike's became just another anti-war film.
And I remember it vividly. It's so, I can't get the image of Alan Arkin naked in a tree out of my mind, you know? Did you?
I'll tell you a story. It was myself and Norm Fell and Marty Balsam, and we were in Mexico, and in Guaymas, Mexico, filming Catch 22, which was later filmed in Italy. So we didn't get the Italian part. We got the crew in Mexico.
Right.
So they usually tell you, you know, like 2 or 3 days in advance. So there was nothing to do in this small little Mexican village. It wasn't even Hermosillo. It was outside of Hermosillo. And so we all went to the cantino. And unfortunately, I had a few too many tecates. And then they said, okay, you're going to shoot tomorrow. And I didn't know I was scheduled to shoot. So I was in the scene. I had a terrible hangover. And it's a scene where that you mentioned, Yossarian is up in the tree, naked in the tree. And so I'm doing the scene, and I'm feeling terrible. And I just said, please, everybody remember your lines. Don't anyone blow any lines. I have to get back in my trailer and lie down. and Dick Benjamin, I remember he was in the scene, and I had this ephemeral quality. And Mike said to me afterwards, he said, that's what I'm looking for in Major, Major, Major. And I thought to myself, well, I can't get drunk every night to play this character.
Did you drink more? Or did you just kind of draw from what he had analyzed you yes, should become? Yes. Act completely hazed over. Did that movie come about, Bob, because you in 62 you did Hell is for Heroes? Because that was your big that was before.
Well, you know, the story of Hell is for Heroes is, I was doing a Sullivan show. I was in New York, I was at the Hampshire House. And I had a meeting with a guy named Bob Pirosh. And he came up and he said, I have this movie I'm going to do that I'm going to direct called Hell is for Heroes. And it's the story of this company, this squad of men. They pull a whole division out. I think it's maybe a true story. They pulled a whole division out and just left the squad. And it was up to the squad to make noise so that they thought the division was still there, whereas they were moving them to another place.
Right.
And so it was Bobby Darin and Fess Parker, Harry Gardino, and myself, Nick Adams. And then I didn't hear anything. And then it became a Steve McQueen movie. They added Steve McQueen to it.
Just a little addition.
Yeah. And it became a Steve McQueen movie. You know, it wasn't that funny show that I had agreed to do. And I don't think Bobby and Steve got along, because I think it really was Bobby's movie originally. I think that's the way Bobby saw it anyway.
Right.
And so my money, in the meantime, my stand-up money had gone up considerably. It doubled or tripled. So I tried to get killed in the movie. Well, first of all, it wasn't the movie I had agreed to do. I kept going up to Don, the director, whatever his name was. He did a lot of Clint Eastwood movies.
Don Siegel?
Don Siegel. Siegel, right. Exactly. And I would say to him, you know, Don, you know, when that tank comes over the hill there, I could like trip and fall and like the tank could run over me, you know. And I was trying to fill some of those.
Is there a foxhole I can fall in?
And he said, no, you're into till the end of the movie. So forget about it. Well, that was Hell is for Heroes, which was a totally different movie than.
But you were funny in it. I remember you being this odd. I remember seeing. I literally have seen everything you've done, pretty much, Bob. And we never talked about this, but you were a company clerk in the movie, and you were broadcasting crank radio messages to enemy lines in World War II. That's the character, right?
That Bob Pirosh, he wanted me to write the phone conversations, the phone that we knew the Germans had tapped into our phone lines.
Right.
So this was just supposed to give misinformation to the Germans, you know, how happy the men were. I remember because I said, you know, the men I'm complaining to headquarters that the Vichy Swaz were really... they were too cold for a lot of the men. And then they explained to me, well, Vichy Swaz are supposed to be cold. But my role was to convince the Germans that we were a full division of men and very happy, which was the original. I mean, that wasn't going to be in Bob Pirosh's. So it was really a hybrid of a funny movie combined with a Steve McQueen movie, you know.
Yeah, because you were funny. You were funny in it. I mean, it was a runner of sorts.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Now you did serve in the Army on our side in the U.S. Army.
Yes. Please stress that.
Clarify that, because it was the Korean War, and you were on. Of the side of the U.S.
I was stationed in California. I lived in Chicago, born in Chicago, transferred in 19, drafted in 1952, and transferred to California to Camp Roberts, which is halfway up the coast. It's around San Luis Obispo.
Yep.
And And yes, I spent, but I said to myself, you know, it's wintertime in California. And I said, how long has this been going on? I mean, no one has ever told me that you didn't have to freeze to death, you know, in December and January in Chicago. It was nice, you know, and they go through a thing called personnel qualifications. And they said to me, you have a degree. I said, yes, I have a degree in management. And they said, well, a personnel management or factory management. And I thought real quick, because I do that. I think real quick. And I realized that the Army didn't have too many factories, so that I should say personnel management. And they said, oh, great. That's, you know, you can't be sent overseas. That's a very critical MOS, what they call MOS. And right. So I spent the 2 years in California in personnel work, basically shipping guys to Korea during the Korean War.
So, and you were discharged honorably, it says, in 54. What, discharged meaning they asked you to leave or you wanted to leave? That's 3 years of your life.
Discharge meant I had served my time. My 2 years were up.
Got it.
In August of 1954, I was inducted. August of 1952, and discharged in August of 1954. And the Korean War was just starting to wind down, kind of.
Right, right. And it's interesting. I looked up stuff about you and it's all fake news. They just make up wrong dates. They tell you wrong stuff. My parents are listed as other people in Wikipedia. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to ask you, we're going to sell a mattress or something. And then I'm just going to, I need to go through the Newhart shows real quick.
Okay.
And then, and we'll be right back.
Hey, let's talk about diamonds. Selecting a diamond for an engagement ring is not an everyday experience. It's an important purchase, and at Shane Company, we make it informative and fun. And honestly, it's easy. Cut, color, clarity, and carat weight are important. They're your four C's. But here's the deal. At Shane Company, we won't just tell you our diamonds are more beautiful. We'll show you. Come in to compare a Shane Company diamond side by side with a non-Shane Company diamond in the same grade. You'll see for yourself that our diamond has more beauty and sparkle. You'll be blown away when you see that two diamonds in the exact same grade can look so different. Our diamond experts examine each diamond individually and hand select each diamond for its beauty. Whether you're shopping in person or online, we have the same rigorous selection process for all the diamonds we sell. Visit us today. You'll have the confidence to pick the diamond that's perfect for you.
Now you have a friend in the jewelry business. Shane Company and ShaneCo.com.
Okay, we're back. That's how long it takes. Yeah,
you got a sponsor. That's great.
I got a bunch of them. I got manscaping, therapy, mattresses, all kind of stuff. Stuff if you need to get
that's
on.
Great.
Oh, it's good.
You're a hit.
It's amazing. You know, when I started, Bill Burr said, if you have sponsors, you need sponsors, Bob. He was my first guest. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't know why. I felt like
I love his work. I love Bill's work.
Oh, he loves yours. I mean, everybody loves yours, Bob. And it's the truth, man. I'm telling you, you know, Elf has become this Christmas movie that will not go away. And for Gen Z, Gen X, I don't know what's coming next.
Yeah. No,
I'm afraid for all the gens coming up.
They've run out of letters.
Right. So now, Elf, when you made that movie because it was Will Ferrell, did you know that you were doing something special?
When I read it, when they sent me the script, I said to Ginny, my wife, I said, this is going to be a perennial. They're going to show this every Christmas. I said, it's a wonderful story. And it's going to be like Miracle on 34th Street. It's just, that's the kind of movie it is. And what everybody needs right now at that time. That was 15 years ago.
We need it now, too. And yes, it is. It has become that.
I loved it. And of all the movies I've done, not all the movies, I haven't done that many, really. I think I've done 14 or something.
I think someone's calling you. Is it important?
I know they are, and I'm just ignoring them.
Is it important? Does it involve money?
Let me see. Well, that's what I'm afraid of. Let me see.
Maybe it's the guy outside behind the tree.
But I got to put on my glasses to see who I just stiffed.
This is my favorite part of the podcast. So back to Elf. And we all know Will Ferrell's a lovely man. What was the relationship like on set?
It was just funny. I found out that he and John Favreau, the director, John Favreau.
Right.
They didn't get along. I didn't know that because from what I could see, they seemed like they were getting along very well. And the movie turned out so great. I mean, of all the movies I've done, 14. I mean, I get mail you can't believe about Elf. You know,
yeah.
They want me to sign a picture to, you know, hide from Pop Elf.
You're wonderful in it, and it's pure you.
It's fun. It was fun. It was just fun. It was fun working with Will, who deserves a lot of credit because that he could have just come off as like a jerk who didn't realize that he was a bigger than the elves were, you know. Mm-hmm. What kind of jerk is that? But because of his charm and John's direction.
Well, I'm surprised they didn't get along because John is pretty much a straight up guy and he's so damn good at what he does. And Will is a total professional, and he played that character so earnest. It had that, you know, that Tom Hanks in Big type of energy.
Another person couldn't have pulled that off, you know, because of Will's charm. And you wanted him to live, you know. You just wanted him to get to New York City and meet his dad, and you just pulled for him.
It's that childlike quality, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, that you've done a lot of things that will always last forever. But for me, coming up in my life, when you made that leap, and after years and more than a decade of stand-up and touring, and did you love all that stand-up all those years before you did the Bob Newhart Show?
You know, Bob, I think you can understand this. I played Vegas in the 60s, mm-hmm. and in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And I used to stand backstage and they'd be playing my Bob music. And just before I went out, I'd say to myself, why couldn't I be a singer? You know, why couldn't I just be a singer? I don't want to be a stand-up. But they're paying me this crazy money to be a stand-up, and you know, I just want to be a singer. And then I realized that sometimes it doesn't work. You know, when you're a stand-up, it doesn't work.
Right.
I mean, the singer can always, the band gets louder, you know. But you're out there in one by yourself, and it doesn't work. And then I realized that's why I was doing it.
Exactly.
Sometimes it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Which sounds crazy.
It's the challenge. And sometimes I take it. Sometimes if I'm doing a lot of it, which I obviously haven't been because of where we've been the past year and a half.
Sure.
But I'm planning to do it again because I want to do a new special, which is equivalent to having done a comedy album. And then they take that special and make a comedy album out of it these days. They used every part of the cow now. But what's, which is a lovely expression for vegetarians. They use every part of the tofu now. But, you know,
which only butchers know what that means.
Yeah, everybody. My dad was in that business. That's where my metaphors are meaningless to anyone unless they're a steak eater and they like pelts. But you know, that when I'm on the road and I'm working out stuff, and I come home a lot, I don't stay out. You know, I don't do what friends do with a tour bus and all that. I I'll do 4 days in a row and then I'll come home for 2 weeks. And I do it at my pace and I love it. And then I miss it because I'm not oversaturated doing it. But it does get old if you've got weeks on end, a different city every night. And then some nights you're going like, what's this audience? They're not getting it. And that is what you're saying. That's why you want to do it. That's
it. I know. It's wow. What a revelation that was when I realized, oh my God, that's why you're doing it.
Well, that's
dangerous. It's dangerous.
That's where brilliance comes from, though. That's what made you what you became as a performer, because you'd already been kind of performing and you were kind of following the Bob and Ray. I know you loved them.
Yeah, I love Bob and Ray. Yeah.
Right. And following the radio people. And then that's what Button Down Mind was. You know, it had a radio feel to it and it became comedy album, which was this amazing new thing. And then here you are out doing live performing, and the Bob Newhart Show wouldn't have come to pass without that, the chops that you got from performing live and acting on. You were acting on stage because you were always doing interactions with other people that weren't there.
Well, you know, because all stand-ups, all we do is we observe people, you know, and we make notes, like somebody has a funny walk or somebody has a funny way of talking and you go, oh, I got to remember that guy because that was funny the way he talked.
Right.
You know, and you just file these things away in your head, like I'm going to use them one day. And you become an actor because you're observing life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then, okay, I got to bring him up. I do want to talk about the show. It's just not that long because I can only worship you so much. I mean, no, you're one of my true heroes, Bob. And a lot of people's hero. I'm just telling you, you're revered. You're what they call a goat. I don't like being called a goat because I'm not worthy, but you are a goat. And that means that you live in a barn.
Okay.
You live in a barn. No, it's greatest of all time. Great, like Muhammad Ali.
And I sleep on straw, so I must be a goat.
Well, if you ever need to find a needle, you're not going to find one in that.
No.
I got nothing. It's a good thing I'm not on tonight. But so here you are.
Well, thank God you're never going to use this. That's a great
thing. No, this is all on the floor. No, but the great thing about podcast is every part of the cow is it all gets used, every part. You became friends with Rickles. You were on his TV show that lasted, I think, one season or something, the Don Rickles Show, right?
I did CPO Sharky and then he had a domestic. show, a wife and kids and
right. That was 1972, right?
Is that what it was? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what
I guess. Yeah, about the same time.
Right.
Yeah.
So and
I remember because I'm on his show and I'm backstage, and he's doing a scene with his wife, and he says he comes into, "Hi, honey. Hi. What's the kid's name?
Not known for being off book.
That's right. He had the worst time with words. He just, he made it so intense, you know, and rather than just being loose and saying, okay, all right, hey, that was fine. All right, those weren't the exact words, but they're good enough, you know, but he'd get so intense about it, you know.
And when you were on his show, that was when the Bob Newhart Show started. It was around that same time.
I think Don was on Newhart. I think he was on Newhart.
Well,
yeah.
It says here Don Rickles Show was in 72 and the Bob Newhart Show was starting in 72, unless them.
Same time, I guess, yeah.
I guess. Who knows? People aren't sitting
at home.
Well,
yeah, but I was on his show, so I couldn't have been, unless we did different nights. But
I would think you would have just done your show without any other thing getting in your way, because that's what you did for those years from 72 to 78.
All right.
But is that when you became friends with him, or had you been friends with him before that?
I'll tell you a story. Jenny knew Barbara before I started dating Jenny. And Barbara was a secretary for an agent at GAC.
Jack Gilardi.
Jack Gilardi. And and so Jenny would talk to Barbara. So Buddy Hackett said to me, when we did a show in New York with, I'm gonna draw a blank. David Susskind, that's who it was. Buddy is on it, and two or three other comics are on it.
Right.
And Buddy says, so in the, David Susskind says to me, you have a degree, a college degree. I said, yes, I have a degree in management from Loyola University in Chicago with a minor in accounting. And Buddy Hackett said, you mean you don't have to do this?
That sums Buddy up too, besides being funny. He wasn't in love with the field of show business.
And I said, I have to do this. So anyway, he said to me, you're Catholic, right, Bob? I said, yeah, I'm Catholic. Catholic, buddy. He said, yeah. He said, okay, I got a girl for you. She's seeing this other guy, but I don't think he's right for her. So I'm going to fix you up on a blind date with her. Her name's Ginny. And then you go out and you start dating, and then you get married, and you'll have kids, and you'll name one of the kids Buddy. I said, okay, buddy, okay. So he fixed us up on a blind date, and we named one of the girls Buddy, which she hates, by the way.
Is this is true?
No. I'll accept the buddy part.
Boy, you had me going, because I'm looking at you. Yeah, I know you don't have a child named Buddy.
So anyway, so Jenny and I started dating, and we got married in 63, and we're married 58 years.
She's amazing. And it's been great. She's amazing, Bob. She's so wonderful.
She's put up with an awful lot, as you know. Anybody who's married to a stand-up has got to be nuts.
Yeah, my wife Kelly loves it, but there's a lot of. I talked to her today, and because I'm on location filming something, and she said, I did some meditating this morning after we talked last night, and I feel better. So, I can be a bit exhausting myself.
Yeah, when you're first married, Jenny and I, this is our first marriage. You really should tell your wife, even though it's not true, that you were married once before, because if you bring up the other wife's name, all you have to do is say, yeah, my first wife used to do that. And she's, I'll stop. I won't do it anymore. Okay.
Well, I don't get that. I get like, we don't have to talk about your first wife, and I don't want to hear about her first husband. So, that's the newer way of looking at it. But you have a good point of civilized discussion.
Yeah.
So Buddy Hackett is the reason that you and Ginny are together.
Oh, yeah, very much. Ginny used to babysit for Buddy and Sherry's kids.
Wow. Yeah, I know Sandy from back in the day.
Sandy, yeah.
Buddy sure was funny, wasn't he?
Buddy, he was very inventive. I started to tell the Rickle story. So here's the Rickle story. So I'm out at the Desert Inn, and Don's at the Sahara. So it's like 2 a.m, but Don invites us to, because Ginny, as I say, knew, Jack Gilardi. And so they knew each other. So I'm talking to Barbara, and Ginny's talking to Don. And we're at the like the cafeteria at the Sahara, you know, because we were Don's guests, you know, so money was no object, you know. And so so now it's time to go in to see Don's 2 o'clock in the morning show.
Right.
Because his first show was at midnight.
Right.
So we go in and Jenny says to me, he is just the nicest man. He has Mindy, he just had Mindy, and he hates being on the road, and all he wants to do is, he's a great family man. And I said, well, honey, his act may be a little different than, you know, than the conversation. She said, well, you always say that about comedians, and you're not going to ruin it. You're not going to ruin it for me. So we go in to the lounge at the Sahara, and Don comes out. First thing he says, ladies and gentlemen, in our audience tonight, the stammering idiot from Chicago, along with his hooker wife from Bayonne, New Jersey.
Did Jenny's jaw drop?
Jenny looks at me, and I said, I tried to tell you.
There will only be one Don Rickles.
That's true. That's true.
Thank God. Because of Stamos, I became close with him. And in the last decade of his life, he felt like a second father to me and a friend.
Yeah.
And he'd always do the thing. I'm telling you this as a friend. I've never liked you, you know, lures you in with the sincerity.
But and of course, with me coming from Chicago, you know, in the Midwest, I mean, I would never think of saying to someone who I'd never met, somebody in the audience, is this the wife? was anyone else hurt in the accident?
You know? It's 50 years of doing that, right? 50, 60 years of looking at a guy, is this your wife? And then he looks at, and he goes, oh. So Rickles always would make you laugh, right? I mean.
Oh, yeah. He was so different from the world I grew up in, you know.
Right.
In the Midwest, Catholic, you know, and he's Jewish from New York. And
you guys went on vacation together like a lot, right?
Yeah.
What, and you would go on the Tonight Show and both of you would tell the stories separate of each other, correct?
Oh, yeah. I'd go on but Johnny used to do a thing with me. He drove me crazy, but he was a good friend. And, you know, you do the notes before you go on with Johnny. And then, you know, and I'd have Bob and Rickles just came back from vacation. Bob has a funny story about Don, and that's like the opening question, you know.
So
I come on, and ladies and gentlemen, Bob Newhart, hi, John, how are you? Did you ever go skeet shooting? I said, what? Did you ever go skeet shooting? And I know there's nothing on the notes about skeet shooting. What's he doing? He would do that to me all the time. He'd throw me a curve. but then he'd, you know, then he'd take you back just to see what your reaction is going to be, you know.
Well, you were one of Johnny's favorite comedians, period, because he came up loving Bob and Ray and loving that whole dry sense. People call it dry. It's just
it's Midwestern, you know.
Midwestern. It's every man is what it is. It's just you were on The Tonight Show throughout all of the Newhart shows, every single one you ever did. Was that pretty much your favorite show to go on during that whole time?
Yeah, well, I filled in, you know, I filled in for Johnny, I think 80 times, I guest hosts.
I can't believe that. 80 times. That's insane. What was that like?
Well, it was, I mean, I did, at one point, I did 3 weeks in New York. Filling in for Johnny. And at the end of the 3 weeks, I mean, I was a limp dish rag. I just was totally worn out. I mean, and this man did it for 30 years, you know.
Yeah.
It's but you have to love doing that show more than anything else, because that's the only way to survive.
Right.
And I knew I didn't want to ever be the host, you know. And God loved him.
Let me tell you, doing 80 shows, that's almost like having done it. That's a lot of hosting. So I have to ask you about the Bob Newhart show. It's a show that you came into it and you just came out of the gate with one of the highest quality shows that television's ever had. And so that experience, the moment that you were on the air, that it started, was it a ratings favorite at the very beginning?
Well, we were very lucky. I mean, we were on the Saturday night, you know, Murderers Row, which was All in the Family, MASH, Mary Tyler Moore, us, and Carol Burnett. It was an incredible time slot, you know, to be in.
Right.
And thank God, yeah. I mean, that was, we used to get numbers that were, they were like Super Bowl numbers. You know, it was like 42 share, 45 share. You know, it was, because as you said before, there were three networks. And some people would have said 2.5 networks at that time.
Right. Is there any episode that stands out or any crazy thing that happened during the run of that show that stands out? Is there one or two things that were the most meaningful of all of it?
Oh, there's so many. I remember one show. I came into the reception, and Marcia's there, and she said, you have a client in your room. And so I opened the door. And this goes back because of years of, you know, of stand-up in clubs. So it's a ventriloquist, and he's there with his dummy. His dummy is Dickie. I guess his name is Dickie, something like that. Jackie, something like that. That's the dummy's name. And I said, yes, what can I do for you? And he says, Jackie wants to go out on his own. I said, well, he said, the dummy says, are you deaf? He said, the dummy wants to go out on his own. So I got to keep a straight face and talk to this guy.
Right.
Because he's making the words come out of the dummy's mouth, you know.
Right.
That's one of my favorite pieces of writing. There were others. There were some good shows we did. I remember the one I hear the most about from people is the Mugu Gaipan show, which was the Thanksgiving show,
right?
Where we all get together and we watch a football game, and we have too much from the brown jug, and then we decide to order some Chinese food.
I remember it. Yeah,
and Mugu. You want Mugu Gaipan? More Mugu Gaipan. That's the one people seem to remember the most. It was great. Again, it was great writing. It just was great. Great writing and a great cast. And then I took all the credit for it. So,
who was your main writer, showrunner on that?
Oh, we had Jay Tarsus, Patchett and Tarsus.
Right.
We had the Charles brothers that later went on to Taxi and other shows. We just had great writing year after year after year.
Yeah.
Again, Lorenzo and Dave were the original, were the original writers.
Now, I know that when you started it and with the other two incarnations, which were, I'll ask you briefly about those too, because I know you want to go back to your life at some point. But
What did I do before this, by the way? Can you help me out? I'm confused.
You have a wife and a man behind a tree.
Oh, that's right. Thank you. It's all coming back to me now.
So you didn't want to have kids on the show. So that was like, did CBS want you to have children? And then you just vetoed it from the get-go?
Well, no, they Lorenzo and Dave said to me, you know, do you have any things that said, no, no. I said, I don't want to have kids. I said, I don't want to be, you know, the dummy dad, the dolt of a dad who keeps getting in trouble and the kids and the wife get together and get him out of it. And then and then the last scene of the show is, we love daddy, but we know he's not bright. You know,
I did that. That's why it was such a brilliant show too, because it was an adult show. It was watching a married couple get through life. You get through your work, and you're the protagonist. And it was just such a class act. And watching it being filmed was such a class act. It wasn't. Yes, after you did a scene, right? I mean, I was there. Writers would come in, 10 writers, but it didn't take 30 minutes of discussion. You know, you would have a little review and then redo it. Some shows I would go see Cheers or Taxi, and there would be like, you know, 20 minutes go by until they figure out.
Or really?
Friends, the audience would end up, you know, a lot would leave because it would take so long to get it right.
Oh, sure. And then, you know, how many times can you do the same line? You do it maybe twice, but you can't do the same. You can't do a line five times and expect the audience to. I was always concerned. I would always say, hey, we're losing the audience. All right, let's, you know, let's pick this up at the end of the show, but let's not lose the audience because they're sitting there, you know. And
I would always say, you know, it takes less time to shoot it again than it does to discuss what we want to do to fix it, because we're all losing energy. So
yeah.
And then so that goes away. You're nominated all the time, but you don't win Emmys.
Not at all. I wasn't nominated all the time.
You weren't? I thought
No, I was nominated occasionally.
Well, occasionally feels like all the time.
Oh, okay. All right.
In this day and age, well, no, there are people that are nominated all the time. And you did, I do have to say that you won the Emmy for Big Bang Theory, which was, you were on many times.
That's right, yeah.
And that was a fun experience for you, I assume.
That was great, yeah. Chuck Lorre came to me over the years. Chuck was doing, he did Roseanne, he did Sybil. He did the Brett. Trying to think of the name again, but he did these
Brett,
these
Brett
shows.
Butler.
Exactly, yeah. And he would come when we'd be on hiatus, and the stage was empty. He'd come over and he'd just sit in the stage, because that's the show he wanted to do. And so he would come to me. And he'd say, he'd call me like every year, and we were trying to hit on a show we wanted to do together. And I didn't really want to do Two and a Half Men, which he understood. And so this is, I guess this was 2013, 14, something like that. He said, he called me up. He said, I've come in for my annual turndown. I said, no. I said, no. I said, I like the Big Bang Theory. I like the writing. I like the people on it. And I'm still able to do that. I still know how to do that.
Right.
And he said, okay. He said, I'll write a script for you and we'll create a character and you'll be on occasionally. And mm-hmm. I said, great. Cause I missed it. I really missed, you know, I always said, you know, I still have my fastball. It was more like 42 miles an hour, but I still had it, you know?
Yeah, you were great on it. You were great on it. And
it was great. Again, great writing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have great writing, you know, forget it, you know?
We're going to take one more break, and then I'm going to ask you just a couple more things, because we got to talk about the ending of the Bob Newhart Show, which made television history. And always will. And it'll be, and then you'll be able to go and figure out what you're going to do the rest of your day, which I believe you're busy. I believe you get a lot of calls, and this is really gracious of you right now. So,
okay, yes, you're right.
Okay.
You're
right. How
many shows are you going to make out of this?
This is one because people love you, Bob. And that's just the truth. So sorry, sorry. It's just the truth. We'll be right back. So now, how did they come to you to go, okay, let's do Newhart? So this is 4 years after you had finished the Bob Newhart show.
Okay, yeah, I always knew I was coming back because I loved doing television. I loved doing a live show in front of an audience. And I loved the life, which was a normal life. You know, on Mondays, you go in at 10 o'clock and do a table read, and then you'd sit around and talk about things that had to be fixed. And then the Tuesday was 10 to maybe 4:35 o'clock. Wednesday, same thing. You know, so it was a normal life. And then on Friday, you'd come in at 6:30 and do the show at 7:30 and you're out by 9:30. It was, you know, it was a normal life. So I knew I was coming back to television. So MTM, I said to my manager at that time, Arthur Price, who was one of the founders of MTM. Mm-hmm. I said, Artie, I think I'm ready to go back on TV. And he said, okay, don't tell anybody. So he called up the head of CBS Entertainment at that time. He said, I'm not sure, but I think I may be able to talk Bob into coming back. I said, okay, what does he want to do? So he said to me, I was doing stand-up in Seattle for a whole week at the Paramount Theater. Mm-hmm. And we were staying at a Hilton, a small Hilton. And I started in the back of my mind saying, this has a lot of the elements that the Bob Newhart show had. You know, you've got the guests, but then you've got the people behind the desk, which is like what we had, you know, in the Bob Newhart show.
Right.
And so he put me together with, it's terrible.
No,
Barry Kemp.
Right.
And he said, so I said, I'm thinking maybe a small Hilton or something like that. He said, what about a B&B, a small inn in the Northeast.
Right.
And I said, yeah. Okay, yeah. He went to Vermont. He wrote a pilot script involving, you know, that we had this inn that we ran. And he came back and it opened up a lot of other areas. I mean, placing it in Vermont, originally if we were thinking of maybe Seattle, but then how many rain jokes can you do, you know? So we had like town meetings, and we had one show which was we found a witch's body buried in the Stratford Inn. And I said, great, Barry, I think that's, yeah. I said, yeah, I think it works. So we did that. I remember, and one show I remember, and again, Bob, this is because you have a live audience. And we found this witch's body buried in the basement. And it couldn't be buried in church because it was hallowed ground. And so they buried the witch in the basement. And it made Joanna very nervous. So she said, we got to get it out of the basement. And I said, well, all right, let me see what I can do. She said, I can't sleep knowing that the witch is buried down. So I said, okay, let me look in the yellow pages. I look in the yellow pages and there's a anything for a buck. That's the name of the company. So I said, I call him up and I said, hi, now this is Larry of Larry, Daryl and Daryl.
Right.
So I said, I talked to Larry and I said, look, I have a job, but it has to be done today. He said, we're tied up until Thursday. So there's no way we can do it. I said, oh, I'm sorry. It's got to be done today. He said, just out of curiosity, he said, what is it? I said, well, we have a witch's body buried in our basement. He said, we'll be right over. So he comes in. He says, hi, I'm Larry. This is my brother, Daryl. That's my other brother, Daryl. Okay. I said, well, we have a witch's body buried in our basement. I said, how are you doing? He said, fine. He said, I hurt my back last week. I said, oh, that's sounds like rough work. He said, I was crawling under a house. I said, well, yeah, it sounds like, you know, it sounds like rough work. He said, it wasn't work. I just enjoy crawling under houses. Okay, so that's the introduction of Larry, Daryl, and Daryl.
Right.
But the point is, the audience, they went crazy, you know?
Yeah.
You're not going to find that out of one camera show, you know. I went to the writers. We got to have this guy back, you know. They were funny, and
right.
We did. We had him back a lot.
They became what they would be trending right now. That's, you know, that's what
yeah.
Happens.
That's the new word. Yeah.
Yeah, and you had the wonderful Mary Fran on there, who's a delight,
yeah.
And Tom
yeah.
Poston, who I got to know, who yeah. I found out. Because he knew that I had done comedy that was sometimes R-rated. He just descended upon me. And he just said things to me that I would never say. I had no idea he was incredibly funny and filthy. So
Tommy. Oh, God. Oh, that was Tommy. Miss him. I miss him.
Yeah.
So many. Mr. Jack Riley from... so many of the people that
there were both originals. Jack Riley, Tom Poston.
Tom Poston, by the way, was a bomber pilot in World War II. And he told his stories about flight. I mean, he got all kinds of decorations that you would never know about. That, and then the war was over and he was bombing Germany and Italy and going up every day in that plane and not knowing if he was coming back or not because they're shooting flak up, you know, trying to bring down the planes. Then the war ends and he says, I think I want to be an actor. You know, the great generation, and God knows, God, they were great.
Yeah. Yeah, and having had that life experience, I think is where my dark comedy comes from, because I went through a lot of death and difficult times, and some people
did you? I didn't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, I lost a couple sisters, and I lost a lot of relatives, a lot of uncles. Yeah, and that kind of stuff will either destroy you or turn you into a comedian, I think.
Yeah, well, I knew you lost your sister because you had that. Have that charity you do for them.
Yeah.
For her.
And you were so wonderful, Bob, at our Scleroderma Research Foundation yeah. event in LA. You were so kind. You got up, you spoke at the table. You were so hilarious. I just really appreciated that.
Okay.
Thank you. And when we do it live again, I can't wait till we're all able to be in a room and
and
celebrate again.
That's where I saw Bob Burr. That's the first time I saw
Bill
Burr.
Yeah.
Bill Burr, rather, yeah.
And
no, I saw Bob Burr. He's funny also.
Well, that's when I was standing next to Bill. Bill Burr is one of the funniest comedians alive right now.
He is, yeah. He is.
And he adores you as well. And I just want to say I was flipping through channels the other
night. The other one, Ginny loved Papakakis. What's his name? I can never pronounce his name.
Zach Galifianakis.
That's him. That's it. I loved him too. Ginny just adored him.
Well, yeah. I would think you both would, because he's brilliant and he does things in a really interesting way, you know. if you're bored, go and see Between Two Ferns.
Yeah, I've seen it.
God, it's your kind of comedy. It's so dry, and he insults. You're not an insult person, but he insults people and then moves on. And he gets called out, but he keeps going forward. He's so good. I was watching the other night Horrible Bosses, and you're the button. You're the button on the movie, and you're literally the most diabolical person in the whole movie. It's so great. It's so great. And you've known Jason Bateman a long time, right?
Well, no, Jason had been on a show that lasted, as you mentioned, a year, maybe a year and a half, Bob.
Right.
Jason was on that, and or was it? No, he was on with George and Leo, I think. I know that we had a scene together in Horrible Bosses at the end of Horrible Bosses. I thought we had ruined your career with George and Leo. I didn't think you'd ever work again.
I like George and Leo. It was you and Jed Hirsch. It was great.
Yeah, Jed was great, The public, they didn't tune in. So
that's, you know, you don't know. And Jason Bateman was super talented when he was on the Hogans.
Ozark was it was wonderful.
It's amazing. And he's a great director. And he's just a special talent in every way. And he works his ass off, and he's just incredibly, he's one of the special ones. But
nice people. He's one of the nice people.
Very much so. Very much. Yeah. So, and the last effort to bring you back was a show. Did you, and I'm sure you wanted to do it, because I don't think you've ever done anything you didn't want to do, which was Bob, the last incarnation of a show based around you. And I loved that show. So, and
it was Bob, and then George and Leo was after Bob.
Right, right. But I meant the last incarnation of you being your Bob character. Newhart, where everything revolves around your character.
Yeah.
What was the thing? Why didn't that thing fly? Because I loved it.
I don't know. It was, I think it was too early, because we work with the writers from Cheers, and the writing doesn't get much better than than Cheers. And it was about a cartoonist, and it didn't I think it lasted a year and a half, but then cartoons became the hottest thing in movies.
Yeah.
So it was, I think it was ahead of its time.
I would agree with that, because I remember loving it, and I was like shocked, but there's no telling. And sometimes networks, back when I was doing Full House, they fought to keep it on. In Seinfeld, they fought to keep it on. They don't really do that if they love something anymore. If it doesn't get a number, they have to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate for things that deserved another shot. But
yeah.
Anyway, Bob, I can't thank you enough for doing this and talking to me. I just think the world of you.
Well, thank you, Bob.
I just do.
You've been very, very highly complimentary. Thank you.
Well, it's true. I mean, and if Don were alive and I miss him, I know you miss him even more.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
He would crap all over what I'm doing right now, which is ingratiating. He would be so pissed that I was
that's when you know it's a hit, when he craps all over you.
Yeah. We go, enough with him already. I mean, like, I need to hear more about him and his acting.
And Zakakakis, whatever the name, whatever he is. What kind of name is Zakakakis?
Yeah, Zakakakalakalis. Good for you. And we need another Greek, But he was, some people say his comedy wouldn't work today because everything's getting canceled. But he really did come out of love for people. And
yeah.
Very, very special, amazing voice.
I saw him one time, Bob. I saw him one time. Barbara and I and Jenny were in a booth at the Sahara Hotel in Vegas. Don's on stage. and he's working the audience, the front row of the audience. And he keeps walking by this guy, and this guy's got the worst hairpiece you've ever seen. It looked like an animal died on his head, you know. And Don keeps walking past the guy, and I'm going, Don, oh God, he's got to see that guy. That's the worst hairpiece. And he walks by the guy. God, I can't believe it. Next time he walks by the guy, he looks down. He said, "No one would ever guess, sir." That was him. That was him.
I loved when he would have his set stuff to make fun of people, but they weren't even there.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be just some random person that didn't even know he was talking. And they weren't who he was talking about, but he had to get it out, make fun of somebody that literally didn't have any of the attributes of the person he's attacking.
We used to, Johnny Carson and I, we used to go in to see Don at the Sahara in the lounge. And he'd yell, and the black guy in the back, and we'd yell, there's no black guy in the back, Don. There's no black guy in the back.
Oh, my. I miss him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, Bob, I just thank you so much for doing this. And I hope you have just a safe night and the guy behind the tree is gone.
Thank you. And this has been the greatest 4 hours I think I've ever spent.
Interview. Yeah, Lawrence of Arabia is not as long as this podcast today. But give my love to Ginny. And I can't wait to see you in person and be able to go to dinner again. And yeah. And we'll celebrate. We'll celebrate that this podcast finally ended.
Hi to Kelly.
So much. Lots of love, Bob. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Have a good night. Bye-bye. Well, that was Bob Newhart. And suddenly I've stopped stammering. But now I'll go back into it. When you bring it up that you're stammering, you find yourself doing it because the power of your own suggestion is very strong. What a wonderful man. What an icon. Truly a legend. And I'm so happy he did this podcast. And rate, review, subscribe. Do all that stuff. Try to go positive. I mean, I know people will say, hey, you didn't ask Bob this or that. Look, I love the man. I tried to do my best with him. And he is, I just let him say what he wanted because he's Bob Newhart. That was Bob Newhart. Hello. Anyway, be well. You know, that's what I say. Be well. Stay well. My best to all of you. And I don't know, treat yourself. Go online and watch the Bob Newhart show. Watch Newhart. Thanks, everybody. Take care of yourselves. And I'll see you on the next episode of Bob Saget's Here For You. I'll hear you. No, you'll hear me. I'll be there. Bye.
Hello, friends in the Bay Area. Shane Company has moved to a new location in Cupertino, and those doors are open. We're still on Stevens Creek Boulevard, but down the street from our previous location. You've got to come in. We've kept everything you love about Shane Company, the largest selection of fine jewelry, a relaxing shopping atmosphere with our non-commissioned team, a chance to compare two diamonds side by side, and a view of our jeweler's workshop. We've made a few updates, too. A spacious new showroom, rough gemstones you can actually hold, and a fun selfie station where you can get a photo of yourself in your sparkling jewelry. Find the perfect gift, an engagement ring or something for yourself. We're at 19900 Stevens Creek Boulevard. You can also visit us in San Mateo and Walnut Creek. Now you have a friend in the jewelry business. Shane Company and Shaneco.com. Hello, friends in the Bay Area. Shane Company has moved to a new location in Cupertino, and those doors are open. We're still on Stevens Creek Boulevard, but down the street from our previous location. You've got to come in.
We've kept everything you love about Shane Company, the largest selection of fine jewelry, a relaxing shopping atmosphere with our non-commissioned team, a chance to compare two diamonds side by side, and a view of our jeweler's workshop. We've made a few updates, too. A spacious new showroom, rough gemstones you can actually hold, and a fun selfie station where you can get a photo of yourself in your sparkling jewelry. Find the perfect gift, an engagement ring or something for yourself. We're at 19900 Stevens Creek Boulevard. You can also visit us in San Mateo and Walnut Creek. Now you have a friend in the jewelry business, Shane Company and Shaneco.com.